Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us now for the interview is Mark Potok. How are you doing today, Mark?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thanks, and great to hear from you.
Well, Mark, lots going on in the States and the world, and we're going to talk a little bit about some history, about Timothy McVeigh and Ruby Ridge and that whole thing that happened 25 years ago. And if you think it's really gotten better or worse, or if it's changed, or we kind of go from there. But what was your first connection with the whole Oklahoma bombing?
Well, I was a reporter at USA Today at the time. I was sitting at home in Dallas, Texas. I ran the Southwest Bureau out of my house. And the phone rang, and it was my editor in Washington saying that there had been some kind of explosion in Oklahoma City. Nobody knew if it was a gas explosion or what it was, but something was going on, and, you know, she'd be right back to me. You know, about 3 minutes later, the phone rang again, and it was, you know, you've got to go to Oklahoma City now. Hmm. So that's how it started for me.
And now, Timothy McVeigh, What was his design on this? What was his plan? What did he hope to gain from blowing up the building?
Well, I think he clearly hoped to start a war against the government, and was, by the time he died, by the time he was executed, it became quite clear that he had failed. But the idea was that the Oklahoma City bombing was payback. It was dirty for dirty, as he said, to the government for the government's role in the Waco disaster exactly 2 years before. So it was a revenge strike on the government, but it was meant to attack specifically law enforcement agencies associated with the Waco debacle. And more than that, as I say, to start to kick off some war against the government.
Now, on Waco itself, what do you think the problem was? Like, why was there the hate group toward the government? Like, what was it about Waco that they didn't like?
Well, I covered Waco as a reporter from the first day to the last. And, you know, essentially what Waco was it was a group of people who lived on what really was a compound, something like 150 people just outside Waco, Texas. This was a very bizarre offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They called themselves Branch Davidians. And the person who was leading the Branch Davidians at the time of the Waco debacle was a guy named David Koresh, originally named Vernon Howell. Koresh preached to his followers that the confrontation with Babylon, meaning the government, was very near, would happen at any moment, and that they would have to meet the force of Babylon, of the government, with force of their own. Meanwhile, the Davidians were involved very heavily in gun sales. They bought and sold weapons, which in and of itself was perfectly legal, but what they were involved in was, among other things, manufacturing, actually using a metal lathe in one of their barns to manufacture fully automatic weapons, that is to say, machine guns. They also manufactured silencers for these machine guns. You know, and in fact, despite conspiracy theorists' claims that, you know, they didn't do anything illegal and the search warrant was invalid, in fact, after the Waco compound burned, after some 51 days of standoff with the government, investigators found 48 fully automatic machine guns in the ashes. In any event, what happened briefly was the government did get a search warrant, and then carried it out, as it turned out, despite the fact that their raid had been compromised a short time earlier, about 45 minutes before the planned raid, which was on February 28th of 1993. It was a huge disaster, as the ATF, it was the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that carried out the raid, as the ATF approached the compound, carrying a lot of agents, something like 50 agents, in a couple of cattle trailers, the Davidians opened fire. There's some dispute about exactly who fired first. It is possible that the ATF shot a dog that ran out towards them, and that set off the kind of conflagration. In other words, but in any case, in just a matter of seconds, it became a full-scale shooting war, at the end of which six Davidians had been killed, and four ATF agents had been killed. The really remarkable thing was that because the Davidians had prepared so sort of assiduously, such a warlike manner for the arrival of the ATF, they essentially won the battle, and the ATF, much to their sort of everlasting humiliation, was forced to back away, hands in the air, you know, weapons back in their holsters and so on, in order to achieve a ceasefire. And then what followed was a 51-day standoff that ultimately ended on April 19th of 1993 when the government finally injected tear gas into the compound, started to break down walls in order to try and force the Davidians out. And as that operation was going on, the compound essentially burst into flames. The claim's been made by conspiracy theorists for years and years and years now, entire industry built up around these theories, that the government started the fire, or the government murdered people with guns as they were coming out of the building trying to escape. All that, frankly, is pure BS. In fact, the evidence is essentially incontrovertible. That the Davidians started the fire themselves. You know, it's unclear exactly what they meant to burn themselves all up, but ultimately it was a kind of mass suicide. In fact, 20 of the about 74 Davidians who died in the fire were found later to have been shot at point-blank range, in other words, executed by other Davidians as the fire closed in around them.
Wow. And now, so they actually were blaming the government. Now, were there particular people in the government? Like, who is it when they say the government? Like, with Timothy McVeigh, was he thinking of Janet Reno, Bill Clinton? Was there particular people, or was it just the whole government?
Well, Janet Reno came to be the kind of the face of Waco. You know, I thought Janet Reno was a reasonably thoughtful person, and certainly did not try and create danger to the children, to the people inside the compound. But yeah, Janet Reno was the face of it. Bill Clinton was certainly seen as an enemy as well. And ultimately, what Waco became in the eyes and the minds of the radical right was the primary example of what the government supposedly was willing to do to people with kind of heterodox religious or political ideas who were involved heavily in guns. So essentially the narrative became, this is what the government is willing to do to its own citizens, engage in mass murder, simply because they didn't like the fact that they sold guns and were into weaponry and so on, and also had a rather bizarre theology.
Well, the Ruby Ridge, event, I guess you'd call it, the Ruby Ridge thing that happened was another one that they jumped onto as well.
That's right. Ruby Ridge came about a year before Waco. It was in 1992. And, you know, it's frequently cited as one of the precursors to Waco and then the Oklahoma City bombing. And there's some truth to that. However, you know, I was a newspaper reporter at the time. And when Ruby Ridge, well, let me first say what it was. Essentially, what it was there's a white supremacist man named Randy Weaver and his small family who lived in a little cabin on top of a kind of mountain ridge top that was known, at least colloquially, as Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho. Weaver at one point sold a sawed-off shotgun to an undercover agent. The government then arrested him and tried to convince him to become an informer for the government and to infiltrate the nearby compound of the Aryan Nations, which at the time was the leading, or certainly in any case the best known, neo-Nazi group in America, a group that, you know, explicitly kind of worshipped Adolf Hitler. Weaver refused. He was a white supremacist himself. And ultimately he retreated to this cabin on top of the mountain with a lot of guns and his family and one family friend, where they were surrounded, and a huge standoff took place there too, much shorter than Waco, but a standoff that lasted for, you know, over a couple of weeks. During that standoff, in the initial there was first a confrontation one day, when Randy Weaver's young son heard their dog barking in the woods and ran out into the woods and ran into a couple of U.S. Marshals with weapons. There was a shootout, and Sam Weaver, the young kid, was killed. A few days later, a sniper with the government shot and killed Sammy Weaver's wife, Vicky Weaver, who was the real kind of hardline white supremacist ideologue of the family. Ultimately, they were talked into, negotiations went on, and they gave themselves up. And, you know, there was a remarkable kind of aftermath in the courts in which Samuel Weaver was charged with murder for shooting an ATF agent and then acquitted completely. So the thing that I want to say, though, it was really, it became a very big deal on the radical right. It wasn't so much that every American was following the Ruby Ridge saga, really weren't. It wasn't on television every night at all. But then a year later, a little less than a year later, the Waco confrontation happened, and that was quite different. That was televised every single night on all three network news shows. Just an enormous amount of attention all around the world. And when finally the Waco building, the compound, burned, virtually the entire nation watched it on television. So Waco spread that. So although, yes, it's true that Ruby Ridge was a kind of catalyst on the right, it caused a bunch of white supremacists to get together and talk about, you know, how can we react to this government which is murdering us and so on. It was only with Waco that millions and millions and millions of Americans began to believe that the government really had carried out this slaughter and that this showed essentially how wicked the government was.
Now, do you think these events, especially Waco, Do you think it has a huge influence on today? Like a lot of the people in the right and the kind of Alex Jonesy sort of world still use Waco. So you think it's kind of like the base of their hatred toward other people?
I don't know if it's the basis of their hatred. I mean, the far right in this country has despised the federal government since the Civil War and, you know, and up to the present moment for its role in the Civil War, freeing the slaves, for its role in the civil rights movement in the 60s and 50s, you know, kind of standing up for black voters and so on. But yes, Waco is incredibly important. It's sort of the touchstone of the movement because, you know, it was this incredibly dramatic event. Virtually every American, along with much of the world, saw it happen. And ultimately, polls showed that enormous numbers of people believed, you know, that the government had carried out murder. At the time, right after Waco, I remember a newspaper I was working for ran a poll, and it found that 37% of Americans felt that the government was an imminent threat to their lives and civil liberties, right? In other words, the government was the enemy. So Waco was a kind of high-octane fuel poured on the ideas pushed by Reagan and others that the federal government was a sort of beast that needed to be, as one of them said, drowned in a bathtub, that the government was not there to help you at all, but had become an enemy of the people. And, you know, let me say, you know, the claims about Waco are utterly false. But that, you know, the idea that the government was incredibly wicked and murderous in its actions, and yet that, yes, Waco still holds that position in the minds of a huge number of people.
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up. You talk about how this sort of alternate reality back then was fueling this hostility and rage towards the government, and now it's 25 years later, and fake news plays such a role in the opinions of so many Americans right now. How do you think that's developed over the years from, you know, believing that Waco was something orchestrated by a government out to get people? And now, I mean, that's tenfold. That belief has just grown and grown.
Well, it's a fairly straight line, really, when you think about the Alex Joneses of the world, you know, claiming that the Sandy Hook massacre of school children was really all, you know, carried out by child actors and so on. In other words, that all of these events, all of these mass shootings and terrorist attacks and so on are really, if you only knew what was really happening, are really the government at work in various terrible ways. I mean, just to jump ahead to Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which was, you know, directly payback for Waco. You know, almost immediately after that bomb went off, the conspiracy theorists got to work, concluding ultimately that Bill Clinton had that that building bombed, and that the reason that President Clinton was so willing to murder 168 of his fellow citizens was that this would be a way of terrifying the American public into accepting draconian, you know, anti-democratic terrorism legislation. So the essential theory was that ultimately Clinton, you know, and the forces of the political left were coming for the guns of all Americans. And they would do this under, as I say, some kind of draconian anti-terrorism legislation. So the whole Waco, the whole Oklahoma City bombing, in other words, according to the conspiracy theorists, was a pretext in order to seize regular Americans' weapons and ultimately to shepherd all of those who resisted that gun seizure into concentration camps that had supposedly secretly been built over the previous 10 or 20 years by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
There you go.
So,
yeah,
you know, a whole series of conspiracy theories. And, you know, that is what we're living with, the legacy of that today. The President of the United States, you know, as you mentioned, talks about the press as the enemy of the people, talks about, you know, I mean, right today, you know, it's everyone who's into impeachment is, you know, actually a vile traitor and so on. who maybe needs to be put in the electric chair. I think that the whole series of events we're talking about, from Ruby Ridge to Waco to Oklahoma City and all that has followed, you know, culminating, I guess, most recently in the murder of 22 people in El Paso, has just been a conspiracy movie, you know, has brought us to this place where people do accept this alternate reality, where people really listen to the likes of Alex Jones and other conspiracy theorists and think that he's right on. He understands what's really going on.
And people think, well, that was 25 years ago. In reality, it doesn't seem like much has changed. In fact, it seems like it's only gotten worse.
Well, I think it has gotten worse. And the reason, well, there are a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that, you know, we are, when we talk about the radical right in the United States, we're talking about a real movement. This is not, as Fox News and President Trump would have us believe, you know, a bunch of people who are off their meds, who need to see a shrink, or some people who have watched too much, too many violent video games, played too many violent games, or, you know, smoked too much pot or whatever it may be. But these are literally the explanations you hear from the far right. You know, the reality is that this is a real movement, and it is based on real things that are happening in the world. What I'm talking about essentially is the huge changes that globalization has wrought on not only American society, but on most of European societies as well. And what I mean by that is very large demographic changes. You know, we are on course to, by 2043 or 2044, lose a white majority in the United States for the first time, obviously, since the colonial era. So, you know, that means real changes. Also, the financial aspects of globalization have meant that, you know, huge sectors of our economy are in trouble. You know, just ask a steel worker, an auto worker, somebody who used to work in a textile plant. So while some people are, you know, doing very well on the you know, income disparity seems to, well, doesn't seem to, it does grow every year. You know, there are enormous sections of the population are hurting. And the third aspect to that is the idea that we're also seeing massive cultural changes. And, you know, the simplest example of that is same-sex marriage, right? And
yeah.
I think 20 years ago, same-sex marriage, right? I mean, whatever one thought about it, it sure didn't seem possible that that was going to be the law of the land. And here we are, with same-sex marriage legal in all 50 states. So essentially what I'm arguing is that we as a society, and really the Western Hemisphere, is going through an enormous backlash against these changes. And we've seen this at other points in our history, but this is a particularly big one. So, you know, that I think is the basis really for what's happening. And now we have an added and really scary element, which is the role that Donald Trump in this country has played. Trump has normalized these ideas. You know, I don't need to run through the roster of, you know, there were very fine people in Charlottesville among the Nazis and so on, and, you know, all of the ways that Trump has encouraged the radical right and made it clear, if not precisely that he's one of them, but certainly that he's sympathetic to white nationalist views. And, you know, we are not the only country in which this is happening. You know,
that's
when
right.
you see, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary or the leaders of Poland or most of the Scandinavian countries, the UK now with Brexit, all of these countries are going through real paroxysms related to the way the world is changing. And, you know, it seems indisputable to me that we're seeing a rise of a, you know, the sort of liberal democratic order is in danger in the Western world. We're seeing the rise of authoritarian movements and leaders all over. And, you know, while this is not the 1920s or the 1930s, this is not Weimar Germany, it's a scary moment. And I think without question, it could and very likely will get worse before it gets better.
And that brings up a really good point. When you see a lot of this stuff going on in the news, a common response that you'll hear is, oh, this is just the final death throes of this movement because they know that their time is ending. When it seems to me much more like they're learning to, they're getting a little smarter and a little more organized. And it's not the last gasp of some, you know, minor problem in America. It's something that's actually growing and getting worse.
Yes, it's resurgent. No, I very much agree with that. You know, it's, I mean, ultimately it may be the last gasp, but we're talking about 20, 30 years down the line.
That's right.
You know, when the United States loses its white majority, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons to hope that the country will kind of right itself. Because, you know, when you look at polls of youth, for instance, you know, the vast, vast majority of American young people have no problem at all with interracial relationships, right? The big bugaboo of the Klan, for instance.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things suggest that, you know, perhaps we'll take a turn for the better. But I don't think it's a certain thing at all, and I do think that...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There are some real similarities to the 1920s. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 1920s, you know, I think people who are sort of lightly read in history, well, the 1920s, that was the roaring 20s. It was the jazz age. We had these, you know, sexy gals called flappers and, you know, nice outfits. And, you know, everybody was dancing in the streets. But in fact, you know, it was a similar time in that the society was incredibly divided. Huge changes were going on. Women got the right to vote in 1920. The 1920 census, first, that showed that America had was the majority of Americans were living in cities. It was becoming an urban country instead of a rural country. You know, this the Stokes trial over religious. Fundamentalism happened then, so religion was under attack. Kind of a corollary of women getting the right to vote was women moving out of their homes and into jobs, factories. You know, sex was out in the open in a way that hadn't happened. So what I'm saying is that there were huge kind of fundamental changes going on in the 20s, and as a result, as one result, we saw the emergence, just as in Germany and in many European countries, of proto-fascist groups like the Silver Shirts, people like Father Coughlin, the infamous anti-Semitic so-called radio priest, and most dramatically, the rise of the largest Klan, the so-called Second Era Klan, in American history. There were 4 million members of the Ku Klux Klan in 1925. So, and ultimately that resulted in the 1924 Immigration Act, which was this incredibly racist quota system, which essentially limited immigration to the United States to Northern European countries, in particular with the aim of keeping out primarily Catholics, but also Jews. But to just finish the argument, what happened, though, was it in the course of the 30s, after the Great Crash in 1929 and the Depression, which kind of bottomed out by about 1932, was that Roosevelt was elected, FDR, and the New Deal was put into place, and things started to get quite a lot better in this country. And then, of course, towards as we got into the late 30s and early 40s, the United States entered World War II and fought with the Allies against, you know, the most explicitly racist and anti-Semitic and barbaric regime you could imagine. So what I would say is that there was a kind of fork in the road in the 20s and early 30s. Germany went one way down that fork, took one turn, and the United States did a lot better. You know, I'm not suggesting that the United States in 1945 or 1950 was, you know, such a wonderful place. And, you know, obviously there were Red Scares and the McCarthy era and so on. But it was in a hell of a lot better shape than it would have been had it gone down essentially the fascist path. So, you know, again, not to say that this is some kind of direct analog to the 1920s, but there's a similarity. The society under huge stress, major changes. In some places, very typically in Washington, those changes not really being acknowledged, right? I mean, there's not a whole lot going on in terms of helping the people, for instance, who've lost their jobs in auto and steel and textiles and all the rest. You know, and you also see the angst felt among white Americans in the opioid crisis, in the you know, the fact that white people aren't living any longer, right? The rise in death ages has stopped, and so on. So we're at a really pivotal moment, I think, and that's really what all this means.
Well, a pivotal moment was World War II, which seemed to kind of make it very clear that Nazis were bad. And I don't know how we got confused about that over the years to where now, as you were saying, the president's referring to some of them as very fine people. But I think that one of the things that may have happened from World War II, and you might know better than I would, that it seemed to shame a lot of this into the shadows more than it was before. And now they seem to be coming out of the shadows. What do you think is
that's right.
the driving that? Because, you know, one of the things that appears to have motivated Timothy McVeigh were the Turner Diaries. And that became sort of a mantra or something that people would look to for guidance about how to deal with this issue. And now the guy who wrote that even regrets doing it. But it's something that used to be more, it was ostracized and shamed into the shadows, but now it's sort of considered more of an alternative point of view. And how the hell did that happen?
Well, a few things. First of all, let me just say briefly a little correction. You're thinking of the author of the Anarchist Cookbook. The author of the Turner Diaries never took it back in any way, and he's a flat-out, he's dead now.
That's
he died in 2002. William Pierce, but he was a full-on Nazi, you know.
That's right.
And a very bright man who ran a very serious and scary organization. You know, look, the Turner Diaries are important. You know, they're often referred to as the Bible of the Radical Rights. There are other books that are important in the development of kind of thinking on the radical right. It is true at the same time that the internet and social media has kind of accelerated the propagation of this kind of propaganda. It's made it much easier to get out to millions and millions of people as opposed to a few hundred at a time. But all of those things, you know, in a sense are a little bit superficial. You know, the Turner Diaries did not create the white supremacist movement in America, or the resurgent white supremacist movement. They played a part, just as the algorithms on the internet play a part. I think probably more important than either of those things is the role that Trump and much of the political right in this country and in Europe as well are playing. You know, so again, I would come back to say, yes, all of that is true, but, you know, how did they come back? Well, you know, part of it is, you know, ultimately I really do think it's a kind of socioeconomic basis of the changes we're seeing, but there are very many important things that have happened. It's absolutely true that coming out of World War II, right, I mean, to be a National Socialist, to be a Nazi, I mean, that was to be a traitor, right, a kind of death penalty offense. And besides that, people who didn't have much interest in anti-Semitism or racism, you know, even, you know, people, sort of regular people, didn't mean much to them. Even they were pretty much universally horrified when the American army marched into Dachau and, you know, the truth about Auschwitz and the rest of the camps came out.
Mm-hmm.
But the radical right has been working on that issue for a long time. You know, and that is where things like Holocaust denial became very important.
That's right.
There was the leader of the first major post-war American fascist grouping, a group called the American Nazi Party, was a guy named George Lincoln Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
And Rockwell did some very important things in terms of trying to make the position of the radical right, and specifically National Socialism, more palatable. The first one was he adopted the idea that, well, he did several things. One of them was he expanded the idea of what it was to be white, right? Real National Socialists, Hitler viewed Southern Europeans and Slavs and all of these other groups as not real Aryans. They, too, were, you know, Untermenschen, sort of under people, lesser human beings, subhumans. Rockwell recognized that white people in America there were an awful lot of ethnic white people. A lot of them were Southern Europeans and Slavs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So Rockwell expanded the idea of what it was to be white. He also, and this is critically important, was one of the very first ideologues and thinkers pushing the idea of Holocaust denial, right? It's all a dirty lie. The Germans never did any of those things, and, you know, some of these people are really quite something today. You know, Auschwitz had swimming pools, and, you know, the inmates used to play soccer with the guards, and it was all a great time, you know, and that sort of thing.
Hogan's heroes.
And thirdly, Rockwell adopted a particular theology. He was not like real National Socialists everywhere. He was an atheist completely. But as a cynical matter, he understood that Americans were far more religious than Europeans, and specifically Christians. So he, this Christian identity, not to get into it too much, but essentially it is a kind of heretical reading of the Old Testament to say that Eve in the Garden of Eden did not merely take a bite of an apple from the tree of knowledge. You know, if you only could read the original Aramaic, you would know the truth, and the truth, so they say, is that Eve actually had sex literally with the serpent. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So Eve's first child, Cain, is the first Jew. So, you know, it's very complicated and bizarre, but the idea is that we've got it all wrong. Jews are actually the descendants of Satan himself, and it's really the godly white men who are the chosen people and so on. So, in other words, he kind of wrapped his hatred in holiness. So, you know, that's a long answer to a short question. It's only a little piece of the picture. But what I'm saying is that there have been real changes on the radical right, and this has permitted what I would describe as, over the last 30 or 40 years, as the Nazification of the radical right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, when you think back to the original Klan, I mean, the original Klan didn't love Jews, to be sure, the second-era Klan of the 1920s, you know, pretty explicitly rejected Jews. But the primary enemy was black people. They were seen as the primary threat and so on.
Yeah.
Today, if you look at most of these groups, the large majority of them don't like black people, don't like Muslims, don't like gay people, and, you know, there's a whole laundry list of other people they don't like, but ultimately they see the satanic Jew, the perfidious Jew, as being behind all of the other evils in the world. So, you know, this is an idea that's been nurtured for a very long time, 50, 60 years now, and we're far enough away from the war that it seems believable, God help us, to at least, you know, a fair number of young people, that the Holocaust is a myth, and so on. And so I think that has a lot to do with these, you know, the spread of these essentially National Socialist ideas.
Well, thanks for correcting me. I guess it was too much to believe that that guy would have retracted what he believed in.
No, no. William Pierce would never retract any. He was a serious guy. William Pierce had been an associate professor of physics when he decided that he couldn't, in Oregon, when he decided that he couldn't stand the sight, this is in the late 60s, of some of his white colleagues going out with black women or black men and so on. You know, he was so disgusted by that, he became, you know, kind of completely wrapped up in National Socialist ideas and ultimately left his teaching position and started a very serious organization originally based in Arlington, Virginia, but for the better part of 30 or 40 years in West Virginia up on a mountaintop.
Wow. So do you see how are we going to gain anything back at this point? When people are listening to news and internet feeds of their choice and no longer open to other ideas?
Well, it's not an easy answer. You know, and if I had an easy answer to that, I'd be rich or famous, I guess. you know, I mean, I think a part of it is simply that we have to live through this very tough transition from one kind of a society to another one, which I think we're, you know, indisputably going through. Mm-hmm. Other pieces of it, I think, are, you know, and this is, sounds like Pollyanna stuff, but, you know, our communities are really fractured in terrifically scary ways. And so there is a hell of a lot of bridge building that needs to go on. You know, and it's obviously been a very difficult time because, you know, at the same time as you have this very reactionary movement, it starts with the Tea Party, you know, now here we are, we also have the rise of, you know, the Me Too movement, of Black Lives Matter, and so on. So, you know, I think there's a lot of bridge building to be done. You know, I'm not really much of a bridge builder. I also think, as a personal matter, that, you know, there's much to be said for outing these people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, I worked doing that kind of thing for 20 years at the Southern Poverty Law Center. However, one begins to wonder. I mean, these days you out somebody, you know, as a white nationalist or, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, sometimes they get kicked off the air or they have to resign their seats, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, and added into all of this, you know, first of all, we've now have this, you know, incredible impeachment process going on. But looking at the longer term, I think the outlook is scary for some other reasons. You know, I think of global warming and the near certainty that in a very short time, in a matter of a couple of decades, we're going to have huge, huge refugee populations all over the world. And obviously that is going to simply redouble the kind of pressures that people are going through. So I guess that's not a very hopeful answer, but that's, you know, where I'm at, thinking about all of this.
Yeah, because I just see things like, you know, just 20 years ago you could have David Duke running, and as soon as people find out that he's part of a, you know, hate group, he's gone. But nowadays, you can be an open neo-Nazi and run for any sort of government job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, although to be fair, thinking about David Duke back in the 80s and 90s, you know, I mean, Duke got over 600,000 votes. Mm-hmm. Running for governor of Louisiana. And he got similar numbers of votes. I think in one of his elections he got something like 60% of the white vote in Louisiana. So, you know, it wasn't so easy. It wasn't like once he was outed, you know, that was the end of Dave Duke. He had to slink away into some hole someplace.
Yeah.
You guys probably remember There was a very, he was running against Edwin Edwards, who was known as a corrupt politician. And there, during the election, a very, very famous bumper sticker appeared, which said, "Vote for the crook. It's important." In other words, vote for the crook, Edwin Edwards, because voting for David Duke, you know, is vastly worse. And Edwards did win, in fact, in the end.
But David Duke certainly didn't go away. He's one of the president's biggest supporters, and he's even talking about, what, running for Senate or something?
I mean, he's finished politically. He'll never win anything anymore.
Yeah.
He's simply been too outed. I mean, you know, he wrote a book about Jewish supremacism and so on. I mean, he's really out there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, while we're speaking of David Duke, let me just say, in terms of the real hypocrisy and lying from President Trump, that, you know, during his election campaign and afterwards, he was asked again and again if he repudiated David Duke, who was saying, you know, vote for him, you know, anyone who doesn't vote for Trump is a race traitor, any white man who doesn't vote for Trump is a race traitor, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump made the claim on several occasions that he really couldn't denounce, the reporters were saying, you know, do you denounce David Duke, his views? You know, he says he endorses you. Well,
yeah.
I can't really do that because I don't really know who David Duke is. I don't know anything about him. And that was, if I may say it plainly, a bald-faced lie. And I say that because Trump, in his first, when he was first thinking about running for president, he was thinking of running on the Reform Party ticket, the party, you know, started by Ross Perot. And at that time, the Reform Party had become very right-wing. And he, Trump, ultimately said no, he would not accept a spot as running for president on the Reform Party ticket because David Duke, the neo-Nazi and anti-Semite, would have been his running mate. So, you know, he comes back 10, 12 years later and claims he doesn't know anything about Duke.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's dog whistle hardly covers it, right? I mean, it's a direct signal to the radical right that I'm not against you guys.
So what's the final outcome? What do you hope people realize and come out of in their minds from the work people like you do?
Well, I mean, look, ultimately what I wish people would do is learn to think critically. I mean, you know, sometimes you will read stories about fake news and conspiracy theories on the internet and so on, and often the authors of these articles make it sound like, you know, kids need to be PhDs in order to sort out what's true and what's not true on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I find that kind of silly. You know, I think that if you have two or three brain cells to rub together and pay attention, when you're reading the internet, it becomes fairly obvious, at least in most cases, what is ridiculous. You know, for instance, the claim that the New York Times, you know, lies all the time about Trump and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Prints things in quotes from him that he never said and so on. You know, but in any case, I think that that's probably the single most important thing. You know, we live in a very complex world and, you know, conspiracy theories are essentially something that not very smart people use to think about a world that's very complex. It takes a complicated world and makes it simple. You know, aha, I know why all this is happening. It's because the Jews or the black people or the Muslims, right? There's a secret plot. I mean, for instance, you know, conspiracy theory like the idea that Muslims all over America are plotting to impose Sharia law on the criminal courts of America. You know, it's patently false in about 3 minutes of looking around with the help of Google on the internet, and you can understand that. You know, the fact is that Sharia law could not be imposed on American courts, absolutely no way,
mm-hmm.
under the Constitution. It would be completely 100% unconstitutional. But you have huge numbers of individuals and these organizations, these Muslim-hating organizations, that keep propounding this as fact. So I just think people need to pay a little of attention. There is such a thing as truth. You know, sometimes it's a little obscure and hard to get to. But I don't think that, you know, the fact that people spout all kinds of theories on the internet gives us an excuse to pay no attention to what's really going on. I mean, you know, it is our obligation, it seems to me, as citizens of the world, let alone the country, that we pay attention and care about what's going on around us. And a part of that is understanding what is true and what is false in an era when falsity, you know, is incredibly widespread.
So now, have you got a website or a place people can look for you and maybe perhaps get some information from you?
Sure. My website is Mark A. Potok, MarkaPotok, .net. And I should say, you know, it's kind of a promotional website. I'm with a speakers bureau and so on. But people can contact me through that site, and I'd be happy to respond.
Oh, fantastic. Any projects coming up, or are you doing any new books or anything?
Well, I just came back from a big event in Washington put on by the National Counterterrorism Center, which is a government agency. So, you know, right now at this very moment, I'm thinking of writing something about it, you know, because I was really struck by essentially what the conference was about, was how can, now that we recognize, even we, the government, recognize that white supremacist domestic terrorism is a larger threat than Islamist terrorism, you know, what can we do? What can the government do? And what really struck me was how, you know, it just seemed to me that there is a lack of recognition on the part of the government or a whole lot of people that, as I keep trying to say, this is a real social movement. So there was an awful lot of talk about technical fixes, you know, can we change the algorithms on Google, you know, that sort of thing. Or, you know, if we pass a law saying, you know, that domestic terrorism, quote unquote, is illegal, will that help? And, you know, I guess my own feeling is these things are small technical fixes and they're not really grappling with the reality of what's going on. So, you know, what might that be? I don't, you know, for instance, helping the people who have been hurt so much financially, economically by globalization. In any case, I'm working on that. I write sometimes for the Daily Beast. I do some speaking. And, you know, slowly I'm starting to work on a book. So, yes, that's true.
Fantastic.
Well, we really appreciate your work.
Yeah. Our guest has been...
Well, thanks so much for saying so.
It's been Mark Potok. Our guest has been Mark Potok. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, a real pleasure, and I hope we do it again sometime.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests,
hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.